topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it.
Luke Savage, staff writer at Jacobin, Press Progress alumnus, and co-host of the Michael Moore-themed podcast Michael and Us, which hasn't actually been about Michael Moore since 2016 or so. Welcome to Shortcuts.
Good to be back.
Today on the show, the circus comes to town. And by town, I mean Quebec City. And by circus, I mean circus performers and also Pierre Poilievre. And the workers at TV Ontario are still on strike, with Steve Paikin walking the picket lines, but we've yet to see Pokeroo. I'm Jonathan Goldsby. This is Shortcuts, where we talk shit about the news.
Tonight, Pierre Poilievre took the convention stage for the first time as leader to rally the grassroots.
You know, the most important job of any leader is to bring hope.
And on Saturday, the delegates got down to the hard work of picking the policy priorities they want Poilievre to campaign on.
Ranging from vaccine mandates to energy transition to what some are calling disturbing and discriminatory policies targeting already vulnerable members of the 2S LGBTQ plus community.
So, as the Globe's Shannon Proudfoot put it, the Conservative convention in Quebec City kicked off on Thursday night with a musical extravaganza in which a man in a Tom Cruise mask and an Air Force uniform scaled the small scaffold, balanced sideways on his arms with his legs stretched out behind him, then played the theme from Top Gun on a guitar made over to look like a fighter jet. And thanks to the CBC's Kate McKenna, there's video.
That's a real thing? Oh, man.
So, obviously, listeners cannot see that, but it is as described. Political conventions always aspire to a level of spectacle, and sometimes they achieve it. A key element of any such event is creating images for broadcast that project the idea of popular enthusiasm for a party, and in particular for its leader. But often those leaders are like, you know, Aaron O'Toole. And the whole thing, you know, in those cases looks as transparently contrived as a circus performer in a Tom Cruise mask balancing on an F-14-shaped guitar. But when the bulk of a party's members actually feel passionate about their leader and see that person as offering a legitimate prospect of deliverance from the tyranny of the status quo, then you get headlines like these, which our producer Aviva collected from the National News Watch aggregator. Things like, conservatives are lining up behind Pierre Poilievre. Quote, they're getting behind something they believe in. Stephanie Levitz in the Toronto Star. Enough is enough for Pierre Poilievre and the conservatives on the rise. Shannon Proudfoot in the Globe and Mail. Pro-choice, gay father, Montrealer wife. Here's why conservatives think Pierre Poilievre can break through with Quebec voters. That's Althea Roche in the Toronto Star. And Justin Trudeau's luck appears to be running out. Campbell Clark in the Globe and Mail. And that's, of course, not even counting, like, you know, the actual explicitly right-wing press. So Luke, Pierre Poilievre seems to have the momentum of a runaway freight train. Why is he so popular?
Sorry, that was so funny that I got distracted from what I was going to say.
That's okay.
Give me a sec. Well, I think there are a number of things happening right now. I think one of them is just that there is an ongoing cost of living crisis, and the Liberals, as the incumbent government, are obviously going to get the blame for that. Justin Trudeau, you know, has been central to, well, he's been almost the entirety of the Liberal brand, such as it is, since he became leader. You know, really, I think, you know, the shine didn't come off Trudeau recently. I mean, he's lost the popular vote in the last two elections. So now you throw a cost of living crisis into the mix. You know, this is starting to look like kind of a more structural shift in the opinion polling, as opposed to something that the Liberals can really turn around. The other thing that's going on, as you alluded to right off the top, is that the Conservatives have, for the first time in living memory, really, a leader who inspires, you know, significant grassroots excitement. I mean, how many people did Pierre Poilievre sign up when he ran for leader? Record numbers of people signed up, completely blowing away the opposition, you know, blowing away Jean Charest and all of the others. So, I mean, I think you're right to say that the enthusiasm at the Conservative convention this time was a little more genuine from the delegates there as compared to, you know, similar convention under Aaron O'Toole or Andrew Scheer.
Probably can't really be separated from, you know, the issues he talks about and how he talks about them. But I also wonder if it isn't just simpler that partisans, you know, of any stripe are especially in Canada, tend to be enraptured by the slightest hint of charisma. And, you know, often our media takes its cue from that and it gains its runaway freight train momentum on its own.
Yeah, I mean, charisma is not exactly how I'd describe, Pierre Poilievre's peculiar quality. I do think he can be quite effective just on a political level, effective in the House of Commons, effective on the level of kind of rhetoric and messaging. Of course, anytime I watch him speak, I always have to remember I'm not the target audience for this. Before he was leader, I would watch his YouTube videos. He has this huge following on YouTube. Mm-hmm. We get hundreds of thousands of views. Those videos are just uncannily strange. There's something very sort of surreal about them. Like, they're very Tim and Eric.
But here's what I can say. A lot of people would say these two men would have nothing in common. We have a liberal and a conservative, a Quebecer and a Westerner. But wait, both of them shared a passionate love for freedom.
Don't matter if you're black or white, there's a difference between wrong and right. It's written down for all to read. That's the U.S. Constitution. It's all you need.
If you haven't spent like 100,000 hours immersed in the kind of particular idioms of right-wing YouTube, they're basically illegible. They're just going to come across as weird, but they really do resonate with a certain segment. And I think that, Poilievre does have, at the moment anyway, a lot of support and enthusiasm within the Tory grassroots. I think that's somewhat contingent on whether the Tory poll numbers hold, because it was only a few months ago that their sort of average lead in the polls was 5, 6, 7%, and it's now, you know, as high as 12, 13, or even 14%. So it's very easy to be popular with the grassroots when you've got poll numbers like that. You know, the election's not going to be for another year, possibly, I would wager, 2 years from now. So we'll see what happens then.
Question for me was always like, question for himself and the people around him was, can he break out of that, I don't always say the box, but I guess who his target audience was for years, people who were right-wingers who were very online and for whom his, what's the noun for, oleaginousness, for whom him being oleaginous was actually a feature, not a bug. And he does seem to have successfully transitioned into the sort of the stern dad archetype that, as Jesse put it, a few years ago when he was running with Jordan Peterson in the New York Times, of all places, a place like Canada could produce a guy like Jordan Peterson, and how Canada sort of gravitates toward these paternalistic figures. But one reason, I mean, not the major reason, but, you know, one reason, you can't really also separate the press coverage of this convention from the fact that the Conservatives, you know, were picky about who got to attend, or at least by standards of how these things usually go. People like Nora Laredo, who was going to cover it for The Maple and the U.S.-based Real News, wasn't allowed in. Martin Lukic from The Breach was also not accredited. I believe Tasha Carradine, who's a Conservative but who supported Jean Charest, was also not allowed in, whereas The Rebel was accredited, which has not consistently been the case over the years, but they got back. But if we go to like the sort of the relatively mainstream conservative press, the explicitly conservative press, I do want to note something that a tweet of yours, or an ex of yours, or whatever the noun is now, brought to my attention, which was an episode of the National Post Full Comment podcast called "The Working Class Inevitably Becomes Conservative," in which Post Media columnist Brian Lilly taps Daniel Hannan, the Lord Hannan of Kingsclear, for his insights into the proletariat.
First of all, there is no dishonour in resting on the support of the people who actually get stuff done and make things, right? I mean, the people, you and I talk for a living, right? But a country rests on the people who say little but do much.
So they recorded this at the convention where Lord Hannan was a guest speaker. Professionally, he's a columnist for the Sunday Telegraph, the Washington Examiner, and others, whom he bills through his company, Kingsclear Consulting Limited, whose registered office is at the Old Vicarage on Fox's Lane in Newbury.
Now, that's a blue-collar pedigree, if ever I've heard one.
Anyway, he loves how Poilievre can speak to the masses.
How brilliant to have a conservative politician who's been able to turn monetary policy into a popular cause, right? And if he can do that in opposition, I would love to see him in office.
I would say, just to interject on that point. I would say there's a citation needed on that. Pierre Poilievre has managed to turn monetary policy into a popular cause.
It's this amazing thing where, as we said, like, he's, in one hand, Poilievre is speaking to, he's speaking to the issues that matter to people, but he's certainly speaking to those issues in a way that also seems to positively electrify members of the British House of Lords.
Yeah, I mean, what do you even say about this? It's really beyond parody. I mean, I particularly love the way that in that clip you just played, Lord Hannon, whatever his name is, like the way he talks about the working class, like they're sort of this exotic foreign tribe or something. I think that's extraordinary. It kind of tells you everything you need to know about the outlook on display here.
I think it's an incredible metaphor for the, I don't know, maybe it's necessarily contradictory. It's about the disconnect and the connection that Pauly ever has. He's a conservative, very much part of the conservative party in the inner circle, but also been kind of to the side of it. Right. Or at least kind of painting, making his own brand and building his own thing adjacent to it, or at least projecting that image such that not only paint himself as an outsider, but he's able to maybe credibly enough project the idea that he is an outsider such that people who feel like everyone's them over believe that they found some sort of salvation in him.
Yeah, I mean, I think that conservatives, I mean, what you just played and, you know, to some extent, I think what seems to be coming out of the conservative convention, I mean, conservatives believe that they just have this kind of, like, they've broken the code, they've hacked the code, they've got, you know, they've got their finger on the pulse of the masses or something. I mean, that's just, you know, they're drunk on their own rhetoric at this point. I mean, I do think Pauly Evra to date has been quite politically effective. He's managed to kind of, I think, rein in some of his goofier tendencies, some of the sort of more extremely online tendencies that are dooming someone like Ron DeSantis in the United States at the moment. You know, we're seeing more of the Pierre Pauly Evra who just talks incessantly about the cost of living and less of the one who, you know, stages campaign events around buying shawarma with Bitcoin and that sort of thing. Having said that, I mean, there is a cost of living crisis. And I think Pauly Evra, you know, he's not very specific about anything, right? He talks about the gatekeepers. He talks about the working class, the working people, all this kind of stuff. You know, people who make things. I think I've heard him use that that exact phraseology that the, you know, our Tory Lord friend used just now. But I mean, I think any opposition leader who is reasonably effective would probably have some kind of a lead in the polls at this point. This may be a more long-term thing, but even if it is, I don't think that means that a majority or even a sizable plurality of the Canadian electorate is really on board for the kinds of things that a Prime Minister, Pierre Pauly Evra, would seek to do.
But they don't have to be, right? Like that's the thing, is they don't have to be on board with what he would seek to do. You just, you know, that's what the difference between campaigning and governing. They just have to be on board for giving him a chance because they like the cut of his jib or what have you.
Well, that's right. And actually, something else I'd say here is I think one of the reasons the Liberals haven't been particularly effective against Pauly Evra when he's talking about inflation and things like that is because they honestly, I mean, they basically buy the same economic philosophy that he does. And, you know, this is where Pauly Evra is a hypocrite, because if he was prime minister, the idea that he wouldn't just be like smashing the exact same buttons the Liberals are doing, it's possible that if he'd have been prime minister during COVID, there wouldn't have been quite the same level of public spending. I'm not even sure that that's true. But I mean, Chrystia Freeland, the Minister of Finance, has come out and said that, you know, too much public spending is inflationary. So we need to, you know, we need to have fiscal restraint.
I am very mindful of the importance of not pouring fiscal fuel on the flames of inflation.
Which is exactly the philosophy that Pierre Pauly Evra adheres to as well. So, you know, once you've signed up for that, as the Liberals have, you know, you're kind of in a bit of a bind when someone runs against you and says, well, public spending is to blame. All this public spending is the reason why the cost of living is so high. It's the reason we have inflation. Well, when the Liberal Minister of Finance has spent months saying that exact same thing, it's going to be kind of hard to run against that. So I think the Liberals, to some extent, are in a you know, this is a problem of their own making.
Yeah. So, I mean, Pauly Evra has, in significant part, he's managed to tap into the Maxime Bernier crowd without, you know, while keeping a lot of the more overtly, much of the more overtly hateful and white supremacist stuff, like, out of sight. Like, I mean, that does not, like, he does not talk about, I don't, like, he does not dog whistle in the same way. But one minority that apparently, that, you know, is once again popular to pick on is LGBTQ2S plus people. So in addition to all the aforementioned headlines about, you know, the traction that the Conservative Party is getting, there were a lot of headlines, like, you know, this did make the front pages, about the policies that were adopted at the Conservative Party convention. Now, policies adopted in a part of a official party policy does not necessarily mean that they're going to be part of a campaign platform. It's like a, it's almost like a public consultation, like when a government does a public consultation, like they'll, maybe it'll inform it and it'll be used to justify things they wanted to do anyway or ignore it if they don't. There are a number of problematic ones, a couple in particular, both of which passed. One, a conservative government will protect children by prohibiting life-altering medicinal or surgical interventions on minors under 18 to treat gender confusion or dysphoria. The other being the Conservative Party believes that women are entitled to the safety, dignity, and privacy of single-sex spaces, e.g. prisons, shelters, locker rooms, washrooms, and the benefits of women-only categories, e.g. sports awards, grants, scholarships. Both of those passed, but I did find it interesting that the first one, against gender-affirming care, passed with a smaller majority than the latter did. It passed with 69%, which is actually one of the lower margins by which any policy resolutions passed, whereas the latter passed with 87% in favor. And I feel like there's something to be learned from that slight difference, particularly in terms of this, what I thought was actually a really good, quick, passionate speech from a doctor in Nova Scotia who spoke out against the ban on providing gender-affirming care.
My name is Dr. Lisa Bonang. I'm a family physician in Central Nova. I rise to speak against this policy. As a family physician, part of what I do is determine competency, capacity for consent, and age alone does not determine the ability to consent. This policy stands against the values of our party to embrace freedom and bodily autonomy. A vote for this is voting against what you say you are all against for, and is pure hypocrisy.
By framing it as a matter of bodily autonomy, that was actually really smart because she would have known that a few minutes later they would be voting on a motion or a policy proposal around vaccines and saying that people ought to have control over their own body and think and what happens to it, and really put the, pointed out the hypocrisy, and it seems like that may have made the dent. And I think that's really interesting and really, I don't know what exactly to learn from that.
Well, I'll just note that Pauly Everett was asked about this when he was visiting Nanaimo earlier this week, and his response was notably pretty evasive. You know, he wouldn't say whether he's going to run in this or not. He said, "We've just got a whole book of new policy proposals passed through the convention. I'll be studying them carefully and talking with our caucus members on those policies. And then when we've had a chance to do our homework, we'll have more to say." So, you know, it's a pretty absurd evasion there. I mean, I would be surprised, I have to say, if Pauly Everett did run on this stuff. And I think as long as he can maintain a lead in the polls, you know, social conservatives are not going to, you know, necessarily be a problem for him. But there's no getting around the fact that, you know, this is where the energy, much of the energy anyway, the grassroots energy on the right is at the moment, even though it's a tremendous electoral liability, right? I mean, I will say, as somebody who used to, you know, cover the right, particularly in Western Canada a lot when I was at Press Progress, you know, I've spent hours listening to social conservatives talking to one another. And I mean, they are by and large convinced that the majority of people actually agree with them. This is one of the reasons they're so absolutely relentless in pursuing this kind of thing. It's because they think that, you know, pronouns, drag time, story hour, whatever this sort of right-wing bogeyman of the week is, they think that the majority of people actually agree with them. And it's just, some like minuscule liberal elite at the top that's imposing this on everybody else. And that's one of the things that gives them the confidence to so kind of doggedly pursue this stuff.
Lord Hannon has another insight, which I think is actually genuinely interesting, speaking about those, speaking of Rishi Sunak, speaking about why Trump, you know, is, people see him as the proper conservative when he's actually, or his run obviously to the left of some of the other Republicans.
I think it's because we live in an age when the vibes trump the policies.
I think that's it's not an original observation, but I think that's a really good way of putting it. And I feel it's a good way of explaining. You have to imagine the Canadian populace at large is not on board with what Pierre Poilievre would offer. They aren't on board with what he is selling.
Journalists and education workers at TVO walked off the job this morning.
Pokeroo and Steve Paikin on the picket lines, Erica? It is possible.
Well, only one of them showed up to the TVO picket line, so far as I know. But then, I guess, well, you don't tend to see both of them at the same time. Employees went on strike on August 21st, and this week, union and management met for the first time since. Although they have remained in touch via email, including one message from TVO's lawyer, which, TVO tells me, cautioned the union to ensure that all public comments, including from its members, were accurate and precise. On Tuesday afternoon, I went up and visited the picket line. Thought it was time to check it out. In part because I can't actually recall the last time there was like a media strike in Canada. I mean, all I can think of is like the Chronicle Herald with the Halifax newspaper back in 2016, 2017. A lot of people are drawing comparisons to the work stoppage at the CBC in 2005, but that was a lockout, not a strike. So it's unusual to actually go on strike, especially in media. Caught me off guard when they called it. A work stoppage is sort of like when you have like a civil lawsuit. It very rarely actually reaches a trial, even rarer to get to a point where a judge is rendering a verdict, is the sort of the threat of the thing happening that forces the parties to get together and just find some solution to have to avoid all of that. So I thought they were just going to, like everyone else, just tiptoe up to the brink of a strike and not actually take the action. But they did. It's sort of, it's a decade or more of pent-up frustration and anger and concern for the future of a public broadcaster that in some ways offers a preview of what a defunded CBC could look like, in that it's something that's been whittled down for decades to the point where it other than children's programming, there's literally just like one show, one regular ongoing series for adults produced in-house, plus a lot of commissioned documentaries. I feel like I need to pull back first and say, like, what is TVO? Because I imagine listeners outside of Ontario might have a vague idea, but don't quite understand. Luke, how would you describe TVO for listeners outside of Ontario?
Well, when I was growing up, it was the home of Pokeroo and the Crawl Space with Patty and Joe. I don't know what they're up to these days, but I would describe TVO. I mean, you know, it's an educational, public service, but I mean, I think it produces some of the best current affairs and public interest programming that's being made anywhere in Canada today. It's really fantastic. It's one of the only places you can go for really in-depth, discussions of politics and public policy.
It is, and it has this weird distinction of being a TV network that is basically held up by the single show, being The Agenda with Steve Paikin, which is a nightly hour-long current affairs show. And they also, publish stuff online, but in terms of what's actually on, it's that and a lot of commissioned documentaries. TVO, it's kind of like, it's more like PBS than CBC is. It originally started in the late 60s, early 70s, the idea being that it would be an educational broadcaster, that it would eventually, the premier at the time, Bill Davis, had this idea that eventually electronic learning would eventually replace teachers in classrooms, and he wanted something that you could show to students in classrooms. So it started from that. It's more a little higher brow than CBC. It's definitely more like PBS in the States. It doesn't run ads. It's therefore more reliant on government funding. And there's not a whole lot like it. Like, there's still the Knowledge Network in BC, which I don't know if it produces its own thing. There's Télé-Québec in Quebec. But it is also weird in that it's this thing that, it's something we remember from being kids as well. And it was one of this rare things, this vestige of a time when there was an effort to actually create or consider a distinct Ontario identity, because Ontario is kind of this weird non-entity within Canada. It's like the definition of middle Canada. There's so little that's distinct about it and that forms any sort of identity. And it was part of the offshoot of that project, hence it being one of the few things that Ontarians have to explain to the rest of Canada. Oh no, this is the shared experience we have that you probably also don't have. But as a lot of the signs on the picket line said, you can't pay your rent with nostalgia. They had, lots of drawings and paintings of like all the different kids show characters.
Well, my feelings about this are pretty uncomplicated. My understanding is that while there technically have been wage increases for Canadian Media Guild members over the past 10 years, I mean, they've been below the rate of inflation. So I think the average salary, the median salary, I'm forgetting which, is something like 15% less than what it used to be. So essentially, there's been a pay cut. As I understand it, there are also issues with kind of employees, workers being kept on contract kind of indefinitely, which means they don't get benefits, they don't get job security. So that's, the classic employer strategy. It's like almost a form of like quasi outsourcing where you don't give people the benefits of being employees, even though functionally they are, and the enterprise wouldn't exist without them. So I mean, what can you even say here? Really admire the work that everyone at TVO does, and management owes them a contract that reflects their important and vital work.
And wages are obviously an issue, but the other issue, the bigger one, is that the government or whoever is on the other side, and that's something I actually found just talking to people at the picket line, is they weren't even sure whether basically they're bargaining with management or with the government or both, which is itself a kind of a strange thing. After wages, the other sticking point is that the management wants to get rid of certain protections for contract workers. So at TVO, as in many other unionized workplaces, there are rules to try to keep people from being kept on contracts indefinitely. That is to say, if you've been on contract for a certain amount of time, you're automatically converted to a permanent employee if they keep you on past a certain point. The fear and concern of the union, which is the Canadian Media Guild, and I should say that CMG is a local of CWA Canada, and most Canada Line employees are members of CWA Canada, but not of CMG. The concern is that the government's intention or management's intention is to have a permanent workforce of contractors and to have a large number of people who are kept on contract indefinitely with no path to employment. And the union has said, although TVO management takes issue with how it's been explained, the union has said that the management has indicated they don't intend to hire people permanently ever again, at least not on the education side. And this, I'm bringing this up because it actually goes back to something else that Lord Hannon of Kingsclear said on that same episode of the National Post's Full Comment podcast, where he does one of the, I wouldn't say it's a mask off thing, but he does say a quiet part out loud in a way that conservatives are not typically explicit about.
And so the kind of corporatist message of the left doesn't really connect in the way that it would have done. You know, I look at my kids who range in age from 7 to 21. I don't think any of them is ever going to have a job, as you and I understood that word, in the 20th century, right? I think they're going to go through life constantly reskilling and freelancing and adapting to accelerating technology. And so trade union-based parties of the left really seem literally to belong, as they do, to another century.
Like conservative policy is often, that is exactly what conservative policy points to, but they don't often come out and say, no, we don't think people will ever have jobs again. And that's just fine.
Well, I think that's an extraordinary comment, and it offers some real insight, I think, into the right-wing imagination. I mean, I'd be remiss here if I didn't point out that Bill Morneau, the former Liberal Minister of Finance, you know, I think in 2017, 2018, something like that, said much the same thing.
We know that job churn is going to happen more. People are going to move from jobs more rapidly. Many of the jobs will be short-term.
You know, young people need to get used to the job churn, deal with it. It's an extraordinary comment, that, because what it's really saying is, I mean, first of all, his kids are going to be fine. That goes without saying. They probably have a freedom to sort of freelance and sort of surf the job churn that others probably don't. But the way that the logic of that is so obviously just inverted, because where, you know, the premise is, okay, there's this job churn, there's all this precarious work, and that's why trade unions are irrelevant, right? Not that's why we need trade unions. And I mean, that really speaks to the way that across much of the right today, and I think for many liberals, certainly neoliberals as well, the market is just this kind of force of nature, you know? It's not something that we can intervene in. I mean, he said, you know, there was that kind of throwaway phrase about adapting to the accelerating pace of technology or something like that, which I think, you know, really is just sort of a stand-in for market forces in his comments. The market is not something you can intervene in, you know, precarious work, you know, low wages. That's not the result of, you know, a very deliberate political project. That's just some kind of like organic development. And all we can do is adapt ourselves to it. All we can do is lower our expectations, lower our demands, minimize the demands we make of our employers and our politicians, et cetera. And yeah, that's just so obviously the exact opposite. His reason for saying trade unions are irrelevant and belong to a previous century, which he says reflects a corporatist mindset. I'm not really even sure what he means there. But I mean, that's all the reason why we need solidarity, why we need trade unions, why we need social cooperation. He's got it in, you know, the exact reverse.
And I think for TVO, I mean, as for the workers, it's as much about, it's absolutely about the future of TVO. But I think for them, my understanding is it's also very much about the future of work, because if a crown corporation can't provide permanent jobs,
yeah, that's
if
right.
The government, like these are people who literally, when they start up, they have to swear an oath to the, I guess it's the king now, they have to, like, they're members of the civil service, they actually have to do that. If they can't provide permanent jobs, if they're moving to gig work, what the hell does that mean for anyone else? And that's Shortcuts this week. Thanks for joining me, Luke.
Always a pleasure, Jonathan. Thanks for having me.
I'm Jonathan Goldsby. We are on X at CanadaLand. People can email me at jonathan@canadaland.com. Like Jesse, I promise to at least read everything you send and be grateful for you having sent it to me, even if I don't respond. Where can people find you, Luke?
Oh, you can find me on Twitter. I refuse to call it X, at Luke W. Savage. Everything I write and publish is on there.
This episode is produced by Aviva Lassard with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our managing editor is Annette Jofo, and our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. The music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Also, CanadaLand has just joined YouTube. Again, we've launched a new channel called CanadaLand Podcasts, and we'll be releasing a series of curated collections over the course of the next month. They'll include favorite episodes from across the network and from across our archive, exploring themes that we've returned to again and again over the last
almost 10 years. We've also recorded new video intros for the episodes in which we wax on like we're Scorsese presenting treasure titles from the Iranian cinematic canon. The first collection features stories on broken systems, and if you're curious which of Canada's many broken systems made the cut, head on over to the Canadaland Podcast YouTube channel. Be sure to smash that subscribe button when you get there. Thank you for supporting Canadaland.